TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Threat to the Planet. How can we avoid dangerous human-made climate change? NASA climate scientist James Hansen spoke in Missoula, Montana and Houston, Texas at the end of October 2007. He addressed the climate emergency we're facing unless action is taken within the next 9 years. TUC Radio brought you his speech. Here now is a collection of the most intriguing questions from the audience and answers by Hansen on issues such as sea level rise, hurricanes, and the ongoing censorship of climate scientists by the Bush administration. Dr. James Hansen is one of the great climate scientists of our time. He's director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and he teaches at Columbia University. Even though he was censored by the White House, attacked by coal and oil corporations, and ignored by the media, he has consistently warned that the impact that humans have on the climate is bringing about changes that may be irreversible if action is not taken now. Hansen says that we need to slow emissions, as another decade of increasing greenhouse gases would practically guarantee the elimination of Arctic sea ice and accelerate the disintegration of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets. In his talk on The Threat to the Planet, Hansen gave an account of the climate history of the Earth. He made the case that mechanisms that caused major climate change in the past are now manipulated by humans. The process behind the much-censored expression, anthropogenic climate change. Here is Hansen's answer to the most often asked question, why do so many people still believe that climate change is not for real? And why do some of the skeptics point to the fact that the Earth is going through regular cycles of cooling and warming at 41,000-year intervals? Hansen will be offering an explanation of the cause for these 41,000-year cycles that are called glacials and interglacials. He has written that the scientific community agrees that we would have now been headed towards the next ice age, that the planet would have been cooling at this time instead of warming had humans not tipped the balance. Ice sheets are now melting instead of growing. Here is Dr. James Hansen, recorded in Houston, Texas, in October 2007.
I understand why it's hard for people to take global warming seriously, because it's 8-tenths of a degree Celsius, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, it's actually a little more than that over land areas. It's larger over land than ocean. But still, it's smaller than weather fluctuations. If you want to notice it, you have to look at statistics. You have to remember, was it the frequency of things different when I was younger, or things like that. And, you know, if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, well, a couple more degrees warming is probably not a big problem. It's only become clear in the last 5-6 years, I think, that a couple of degrees is going to have enormous consequences. So I'm not surprised, since it took scientists a long time to realize how sensitive the system is. I'm not surprised that the public doesn't. And then these things about natural fluctuations, yes, there have been large natural fluctuations on very long time scales, but we understand those actually tell us something about how sensitive the system is, and they also tell us there were huge changes that went with that. The implication, it was a different planet. I mean, even 20,000 years ago, it was a different looking planet with sea level 400 feet lower, you know, so. Yeah, there are natural climate changes that are large, but civilization developed in a very special period. And if we want that period to continue, we can't let the atmosphere become vastly different. Fluctuations from glacial to interglacial are related to changes in the Earth's orbit. But the most important one is the inclination of the Earth's spin axis to the Earth's orbit. The spin axis of the Earth is tilted about 23.5 degrees to the plane of the orbit, and that's what gives us our seasons. But that angle of inclination varies slowly because of the tug of, mainly of Jupiter and Saturn, but also Venus because it comes close. And it varies by plus or minus 1 degree, and it does it in a very regular fashion every 41,000 years. These fluctuations from glacial to interglacial, you'll find that their periodicity is 41,000 years. It's due to these perturbations in the Earth's orbit.
Why do you say 10 years? What are the big factors up to 2015?
Because we've defined a scenario which keeps global warming less than 1 degree. And to achieve that, given there's about 0.5 degree Celsius additional warming, it's already in the pipeline. And there's more greenhouse gases in the pipeline from the infrastructure that exists. So it's not possible to suddenly stop global warming unless we reduce these other climate forcings. But that scenario becomes impractical if we stay another 10 years on business as usual scenario, because the emissions would be 35% above what they were in 2000. And as I mentioned, the gases that would be put in the atmosphere from those emissions are going to stay there. So there's just no path to get us down to a forcing that would keep global warming less than 1 degree Celsius. And I think that's the maximum that we can allow, given the estimates based on the history of the Earth, of how sea level changed and other climate impacts. So it's a rough estimate, but it's based mainly on the history of the Earth, not on climate models. Unfortunately, I think it's going to become clear, and you can see if I'm right, but I say in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to realize that the dangerous level is lower than the 450 parts per million. So we're really going to have a pretty tough job. We're probably going to have to figure out some ways to get some of that CO2 out of the atmosphere. But the more we put up there, the harder it's going to be to deal with it.
And where did the 450 parts per million come from? Why is that the dangerous level?
Well, the 450 parts per million is approximately what will get you close to 1 degree Celsius additional warming. And that is the level that we estimate is dangerous based on the Earth's history.
The elevation of my home in the medical center is 43 feet. Will it be beachfront property this century? I'm also thinking about my grandchildren.
That 43 feet, that's unlikely to be beachfront property this century. You know, the IPCC refused to address this question. They give you a number for sea level change, but that number only applied to thermal expansion of the ocean and melting of mountain glaciers, because we see how they're changing. We can predict those very well, and we can calculate the thermal expansion. But the ice sheet disintegration is a nonlinear process. It goes slowly at first, and then the positive feedbacks will cause once it gets sloppy, it starts to break up, things will happen very fast. And West Antarctica, in particular, is sitting on bedrock below sea level. So if that starts to break up, it will happen very rapidly. I would say that if we follow business as usual, and I've written papers to try to describe the rationale, that we would expect sea level rise of several meters this century. I hope that we don't follow business as usual. But the problem is sea level, once ice sheets begin to disintegrate, is going to continue to change for centuries. So there's not going to be any new sea level where it's stable. We've been in a remarkable period for 7,000 years with a stable sea level. That's pretty unusual in the history of the Earth. It just so happens that the Earth has been warm enough to keep ice sheets off of Canada and Asia, but cool enough to make the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets stable. But if we warm up more than another degree, those ice sheets are not going to be stable. And once they start going, you're just going to get a continuous change for the next several centuries.
What about forceful hurricanes? The Houston Chronicle pointed out that hurricanes were quick to spawn this season. Tropical storms were suddenly hurricanes. Professional weathermen were surprised.
The biggest effects in Texas on regional climate are probably the impacts on both ends of the hydrologic cycle, because global warming will intensify the both ends of the hydrologic cycle. It causes more evaporation. A warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, and so rainfall events, the strongest rainfall events, will be heavier, and you'll have more floods. You'll have more 100-year floods. You may have 300 or 400 year floods per century instead of one, and you may have 1 500-year flood. But also the storms that are driven by latent heat, and that includes thunderstorms, tornadoes, and tropical storms, hurricanes, the strongest ones can be stronger because they're driven by latent heat and you've got more in the atmosphere. But at the same time, at the times, places where it's dry, the higher temperatures and the greater evaporation intensify drought conditions and lead to more forest fires. And if you look at the statistics, those things are all beginning to happen. And we can't say whether there's going to be more hurricanes. That is still an open scientific issue. But the strongest ones can be stronger.
I understand that the United Nations Committee, the IPCC, which shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore on global warming, is conservative and limits recent data so it can reach consensus. What are they leaving out that worries you?
I think it was actually a good thing to have IPCC share this award with Al Gore, because they are conservative and they provide credibility which enhances the way this will be viewed by the public. But they are necessarily conservative because you have to get agreement from all the countries, which includes Saudi Arabia and many other countries. And there is a desire to make sure you don't say something too soon. So the main problem that with their last report, and I've written a paper called Scientific Reticence and Sea Level Rise, and that's the fact that they didn't attempt to give some range for what is the effect of global warming going to be on ice sheets and sea level. And they even gave a number for sea level change without underlining strongly enough that number only referred to thermal expansion and mountain glaciers. It did not include by far the biggest term, and that's Greenland and Antarctica. So they tend to be, you know, some years behind, because they had to shut off their scientific papers that they would include a year before they wrote the report, and then it takes a long time to go through these review cycles. So they did not include the most recent data on what's happening on the ice sheets, and the satellite data that shows the mass of the ice sheets is decreasing and the summer melt is increasing.
You are listening to the answers to questions from the audience by climate scientist James Hansen of NASA. They were recorded in Houston, Texas in October 2007. 2 days earlier, Hansen had given the same speech, entitled The Threat to the Planet, in Missoula, Montana. According to Hansen, carbon dioxide from the gigantic coal reserves in Montana and Wyoming could help seal the fate of the planet if the coal was mined and burned in power plants. A woman in the audience led off the question and answer session with a visionary proposal.
Hi, Dr. Hansen. I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in the world for insisting that the U.S. Congress and administration confront the science that you and the other scientists have presented and not just sweep it under the rug. Well, I'm hoping that you and the rest of NOAA and other people will continue to insist that they begin to think totally differently about what we formerly called fossil fuels. In fact, that they stop calling these carbon reserves fuels and that they instead redesignate them as our national climate preserves. Just as visionary leaders realized that we were not going to have an enduring resource of forest and wildlife and wilderness unless we set aside preserves, we have to stop burning up our climate preserves. It's a very stupid use of them, and instead formally designate them as climate preserves to be set aside to provide that ecological service that we have no idea how else to provide that.
Thank you, Dr. Hansen, for coming to Missoula, Montana. I worked with Greenpeace in the United States in the late 80s when we started a global warming campaign in 1989. I wanted to ask you, as a citizen, with obviously deep scientific knowledge in this regard, A, what do you make of the fossil fuel developments happening in Alberta with the tar and oil sands, the biggest oil development in the world, the dirtiest in the world, and the biggest industrial project the world has ever seen, and also the massive coal reserves in Wyoming and Montana? It seems to me that this area of the world is becoming quite crucial in the battle of global warming.
Okay. One reason that it's very important to have a gradually rising price on carbon emissions, it doesn't have to be much to start with. Business has to recognize that it's going to be there and it's going to increase. And one thing that will do is kill projects that are really idiotic from the standpoint of the planet. And that in particular applies to the unconventional fossil fuels where you're really, this is a case of the drunken addict trying to squeeze the last drops of oil out of the most extreme situations like tar shale and tar sands and things. They just won't make any economic sense once you make the pollution pay for it, the damage it's doing to the planet. So that will automatically be solved if we once take these two steps that I mentioned, and one of them, the second one being the gradually increasing price on carbon emissions. What you see from the fossil fuel industry now, although they put these advertisements in the New York Times and things where, to make it sound like they're really green, they're becoming green and things, but what you have to actually look at is their investments. And you have, you know, ExxonMobil has huge profits. How much are they investing into the next energies that will not cause these problems? If they were willing to become energy companies rather than fossil fuel companies, they could solve the problem. But they're not yet, they don't yet feel the heat. They're not yet being pressured to do that. And until we figure out a way to put the pressure on them, they're not going to do that. And by the way, I think the most effective way to do that is via young people. And we have to make clear the generational inequity that we are, you know, perpetrating on the next generations.
I want to thank you, Dr. Hansen, for your very comprehensive presentation. But I would like to ask about your reaction to a couple of other proposed strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. One is to rely more on nuclear energy, and the other is to encourage a shift from a meat-based diet to a plant-based diet.
Okay, start with nuclear energy. Well, nuclear power produces very little carbon dioxide, a little bit in the making of the plants. Construction, but it's a very effective way to reduce CO2 emissions. Now, it has other problems associated with it, and citizens have to decide what their druthers are. In France, they've decided that they're comfortable with nuclear power, and they get almost all their electricity that way. In Germany, they've decided they're going to phase out every single nuclear power plant. And unfortunately, they don't get it with regard to coal. They're replacing some of the nuclear plants with coal. And they're just treating oil emissions and coal emissions of CO2 as if they're equal. But for the reasons I tried to explain, they're really not equal. We're never going to stop the oil. The easily available oil is going to get put into the atmosphere as CO2, but the coal doesn't need to be. And if you do put the coal up there, you can't get it back. So it's a big mistake of Germany to go down that path. As a physicist, I'm not afraid of nuclear power. There are these concerns about somebody getting their hand, terrorists getting their hand on weapons-grade material and things. You have to guard against those kind of things. But I think that's a local decision. You can, if you decide you don't want nuclear power, you do have to choose something else. You have to allow windmills, or you have to do energy efficiency and other things. Anyway, but the question of eating lower down on the food chain, yeah, that's actually quite effective in terms of reducing CO2 emissions. You know, I mean, we're not going to convince some people not to eat.
But I don't get corn-fed elk.
Yeah, you know, I'll bet. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, the elk is not as bad as the corn-fed cattle.
What do you think about the White House editing director Galbanning's testimony to the Senate today, head of the CDC?
I don't think it has sunk in yet that our democracy is not functioning the way our founding fathers intended it to function. There are two things in particular which I just think have to be said again and again until it sinks in. The assumption in a democracy is that the public is educated and informed and can participate in the decision-making process. But there are two things that are going on which are inconsistent with this. The one is that public affairs offices in science agencies are now staffed at the headquarters level by political appointees. And all the science that is of significance has to go through these public affairs offices, which are acting as offices of propaganda. And that is a big problem. Now, the other problem is why, when a scientist speaks to Congress, why does his testimony have to go through the White House? Where does this come from? It's not in the Constitution. There's nothing. It just came up because the administrations, and I'm sorry to say it, this has applied to both parties, feel that government employees are working for them, not for the public. And so they have this story that, well, the testimony should be consistent with the president's budget. That's really not a rationale. It doesn't make sense. So the executive branch has just arbitrarily taken more and more powers, and somehow somebody's got to start to fight back. And I don't see why Congress doesn't object to these things.
What communities, countries, cities are good examples to you?
Some states are fighting our federal government in court to try to make vehicle efficiencies higher. You know, it's really a crazy situation. When our government is a friend in court, friend of the court, but arguing for the automobile manufacturers to make them less competitive with the Japanese manufacturers. I think that people are getting it now,
But we really do have to make some changes. It has to be more. People can't solve it by themselves. And cities, individual cities, you know, the U.S. emissions actually have sort of flattened out the last couple of years. And I think it's because some cities and some states are trying. But that's not going to be enough. We're going to have national leadership, and we're going to have to do some of the things I mentioned.
Last question. What are your reasons for hope?
You know, somehow people always get pessimistic after I give a talk. And the first reason would be it actually makes sense to do the things that need to be done, makes sense for other reasons. And it's technically possible to do them. And I think that positive feedbacks, if we once get started in that direction, I think the positive feedbacks will cause things to happen faster than you would think. We still have a very innovative and technically capable society in the U.S., and I think that there are lots of things that we will come up with, and we don't even know what they are. If you compare the technology today to a century ago, you could never have dreamed of the things now. And I think there are probably some very smart things that will come up in the future once we really begin to address this. But in order to make that happen, I think you have to give an economic incentive, and that's why you need a carbon price. Once you have that, I think all things will really start to snowball and have some positive feedbacks in the right direction.
That was a standing ovation for Dr. James Hansen, director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York City. You heard a collection of the most intriguing questions and answers, recorded in Houston, Texas and Missoula, Montana, in October 2007. In addition to his ongoing scientific research, Hansen recently joined the search for solutions to the climate emergency. Dr. Hansen is a member of the prestigious National Academy of Sciences since 1995. The president of the Academy called him recently one of the most productive and creative scientists in the world. In spite, or maybe because of that reputation, administrations since the 1980s have censored him. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org for more information and links to Hansen's work. Please find a pen to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order or download the talk by Dr. James Hansen. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or audio tape order or donation is our only support and is essential in keeping TUC Radio on the air. Call toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.